was kind of expecting Pastor Kurt Taylor to show up today in his fatigues, camouflage. I'm glad he didn't, because then I wouldn't have been able to see him. You're listening to the Bible Study. This is the second hour, the Ask the Pastor Hour. Ordinarily, I say you can talk about anything you want. And if that's what you want to do, we'll do that. But we're really here to talk today with Pastor Kurt Taylor on his experience here, recent experience, serving with the military in a time of war as a chaplain. If you want to ask a question or a comment which focuses on that subject, then we'd be more than welcome. Our numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Good morning, Pastor Taylor.
Good morning, Chuck. Good to see you face-to-face.
It was a privilege, personally, and I know also for our listeners who are aware that you were overseas, to pray for you during that time.
That's great.
Were you in danger?
Where I was wasn't... When you think of being in danger in war situations, where we were wasn't constant fire. There was always an atmosphere of threat, but it's not like we were had to dive under desks to get away from the bombing. It was, you know, the thing was, we were in a fortress of a base surrounded by sandbags, huge walls of sand, and so as long as you stayed in there, you were in pretty good shape.
Kyrgyzstan. Is that
yeah.
How you say that?
Mm-hmm.
Where is it?
It's just north of Afghanistan. There's actually a country that I'd never heard of before in between Kyrgyzstan and Afghanistan called Tajikistan. But we were the northernmost point of Operation Enduring Freedom. And Kyrgyzstan was strategic because it's a democracy. And we were allowed to have an American base there. And what we did is we... our mission was to fly fuel, people, and cargo down to Afghanistan. So basically, one of the things that we were was a great big gas station. We had these huge Air Force tanker jets that would load themselves up with gas and fly down to Afghanistan.
And what they're paying per gallon.
and meet up with the fighter jets, and then the fighter jets could get fueled and go down and do their mission. So that's what our thing was. And to get people down there, because we were the last place that a commercial jet could go, because once you go downrange from where we were, you had to be in a military plane that had protective countermeasures. So we'd have coalition and American troops coming into our base from their countries, Spain, you know, France, and then get onto a military jet and head down to Afghanistan.
So you're doing ministry at up in Waltz, Michigan,
mm-hmm.
minding your own business. Married, a couple of kids, raising a couple of kids, living the American life. How do you all of a sudden wind up in Kyrgyzstan?
Oh, it could happen to anybody. No.
I hope it doesn't happen to me.
For the last 9 years, I've been a chaplain with the Air Force, and starting here, actually, at Scott Air Force Base, and then a base in Milwaukee when I had a church in Wisconsin. And then when we moved to Detroit, I got involved with the Michigan Air National Guard, and am a chaplain at our base in Battle Creek. But when you're a chaplain, every few years your number comes up, and they, what do they call it? They volun deploy you. You know, they volun choose you to go. And so they asked, first of all, if there was any compelling reason why I wouldn't be able to go over there. And what they're talking about is, you know, somebody just died or something like that, and there wasn't, so I was happy to go. So they deployed me, and was there from September to January.
So when you come home and your wife says there's a letter there from the Air Force, or did it come to the church? You know, you're minding your own business, all of a sudden, what, a letter arrives?
It was a phone call from my boss at the base, and he said, it looks like they're going to ask you to deploy. And we talked about that, and I told my wife then, there's a good chance that I'm going to be deployed. So we got ready. And
what was her reaction?
Her reaction was, how long? And our rotations are usually 4 months or less for Air National Guard chaplains. But we had a pretty good idea that it would be 4 months. Now, we've been at this long enough now, 9 years.
Who's we?
My wife and I.
Okay.
In the military, that actually my wife and I have been married 20 years, but I've been in the military 9 years, and we knew this was going to happen. One of the things you...
So it's not a shock.
No. And the other thing is that we've had so many friends and members that deploy for 15 months or a year. So 4 months seemed pretty manageable. She's always been supportive, and so when it was time to go, she was ready. She was on board.
How old are your kids?
11 and 9.
And they are, what, boy and a girl?
Yeah, a boy and a girl.
11 and 9. Can you describe for me when Daddy tells the children that he's going to be gone for 4 months?
Yeah, that was the hard part. My wife and I talked about how we would do it, how we would break it to them. Originally, I wasn't supposed to go until this January. In fact, right now is when I originally was going to be over there. So we were going to wait a while because we found out about it May or so of last year. And so we were going to wait a while, but then all of a sudden I got a phone call and they said, you're going in September, not January. So we sat the kids down and told them what was going on. And my son is, I mean, he and I do so much together. He was kind of sad about it and started to cry.
It's going to be over Christmas.
Mm-hmm. And same thing with my little girl. But the thing was, as you present it to them, they know that Dad's in the military. They know that there are times when Dad's gone for a while because he's in the military. And so this was something that had been talked about before. And when it came time, they understood. They were good about it. We did all sorts of things like we bought this big jug of cheese balls, and I don't know how many were in there, but we counted.
For some reason, cheese balls was not the thing that I was anticipating there.
So we counted it to 122, because that's how many days I was going to be gone. And so each day they were going to pull out a cheese ball, and one of them would pull out a cheese ball and get to eat it, and they'd get to watch as the cheese balls would go down and down
that's
and
a
down.
Great idea.
And the other thing was, since it was over Christmas, Thanksgiving, my wife had family around, and then Christmas time, same thing. They did a lot of traveling, and then they knew that once Christmas was done, it was only going to be a couple of weeks. So it was the first couple of months that I think were the hard part for them. But then things got busy, and then it was getting closer. And once you get over the halfway point, everything's starting to look a little bit better.
You know, it used to be, like in World War II, that your communication would be reduced to letter writing, some of which would be clipped out, you know, by Army or Air Force personnel in order to make sure that you don't reveal anything you're not... But now, can you call home on a cell phone from Kyrgyzstan?
Yeah, you can... Not a cell phone, but what they call a DSN line, where you can make a military, you're using a military line, you call a base here in the country, and the base then connects you with the local number you want. You get 15 minutes, and you get to do that twice a week. That's the limit, 15 minutes two times a week. But we had email, which was everything to us. Every day began with an email and ended with an email, and we kept in good touch, and it was great to hear one another's voice. But the problem with those phone connections is that there's a little pause. As you know, when you're talking to somebody far away, especially as far as we were, you'd say something, and then there's like a one-second pause, 2 seconds before they've heard it. So you really can't have a conversation. You can just kind of report what you've been doing, and then they report what they've been doing, and then all of a sudden 15 minutes is up.
Pastor Taylor, do you love your country?
Love this country.
What does that mean when you say that? Most of us would say yes. What does that mean when you say that?
When you've worked with this country's heroes, which I get to do in the military, and you see how much this country means to the people who are fighting for it, you can't help but adopt that attitude of this country is worth defending, this country is worth dying for. And I think it's kind of hard to explain. I suppose it's a little bit like when somebody asks you for the hope that you have when they know that you're a Christian. There's so much you could say. How do you put it simply? you know, if somebody asks about the hope that I have in Christ, I tell them he died for me and rose for me, and because of Jesus, I'm going to live forever. As far as how one expresses their love for country, it's almost like you want to say, we've been given so much here. This nation has been so blessed by God. We have so much here, so much opportunity, so much freedom, the ability to live our lives in a God-pleasing way, worship freely. There is just so much that we have because we're Americans that it doesn't seem too much to ask to go over and serve our country for a few months. That's the way so many in our military look at this. There are a lot more hardships out there than what we dealt with my 4 months gone. As I said, you have Army soldiers deploying for 15 months. You ask them, why do you do this? And they will say, because I love my country. There are always other sorts of reasons why people get into the military, get bonuses and schooling and all of that. But to a person, Chuck, the people that are serve because of how much they love the United States. When they see the flag, there is still a thrill. When you get to salute the flag, which we get to do when we're in uniform, and I say get to do, it's a rush. You get goosebumps because this is your country, and it's a great thing to feel.
Well, I'm not a chaplain, and I'm pretty sure I'm too old to be of much value to the Air Force or the Army or anything else. But if I were to go over and do what you did, if somehow, boom, I find myself in your boots for 4 months, is there any way that you can describe for me how that might change me?
What changes you, especially if you're a chaplain, what changes you is all the different things that you're responsible for. And being the go-to guy when anybody has any sort of an issue, I was the only Protestant chaplain on base. We also had a Roman Catholic priest, and we had a base of about 1,300 people. So that, you're the only one that can provide completely confidential counseling. So if somebody wants to go off about their boss or some issue they're having, the chaplain is the only one who can guarantee that what they say to you will never go anywhere. And so you learn about people. You learn about their lives. We had individuals coming up from the hot zone down around Kandahar talking about what they saw, things they had to do, and listening to that and trying to talk them through it from a gospel perspective, because that's when we can bring the gospel into our conversations. You realize that what God has to offer to people who have been in the worst of circumstances is life-changing. There was one instance where I was sitting with a young man who saw some awful things, and I saw, as I presented to him the same thing that you would have said, that any of our listeners would have said about the love of God and how Jesus died for us, I watched his life change right in front of me. He had dabbled in religion when he was younger. He knew there was a God up there, but this was it. This was the moment that the Holy Spirit chose to go into him and make him a believer. Missionaries can tell these stories. Many of us can tell these stories. But when you're in the war zone and someone has been now grabbed by the Holy Spirit and their life has been changed, that changes you. To have the privilege to minister to commanders, people who make life and death decisions, where what you say matters to them, changes you. I would say that the thing that changed me the most was the camaraderie that we had among the chapel community. There were a number of individuals. We had about between 100 and 150 that were actively part of our chapel that would come to all the services and Bible classes. We grew so close to each other during that time. People from all sorts of different Christian backgrounds, Lutherans, Pentecostals, Methodists, everywhere. We grew so close to each other, and were able to embrace each other so often because of our common faith, that the neat thing was, you're over here across the world from everything that's normal and everything that you're used to, and yet you have brothers and sisters in Christ who are sitting there with you, going through it with you, and that was a tremendous source of strength, and that changes you too.
There, I can't remember the saying. There's a saying, there's a cliche, and I can't remember it, but something like there are no denominations in foxholes or something like that. In the United States, where we have many denominations, and those denominations have various distinctions, and people are pretty serious about those distinctions. They want to maintain those differences in identity, from Lutherans to Catholics to Presbyterians to Pentecostals and on and on. How does that play out in your situation, where you got one Roman Catholic priest and you've got one Protestant, in your case a Lutheran pastor, and you've got 1,300 people, maybe some or most of them have some kind of Christian identity, and the one thing I know you're not going to do is say to the Assembly of God soldier, "Oh, you're Assembly of God, I can't help you. You know, go." You're not going to say that. Right. How do you handle that?
One of the great things that I've experienced in the Air Force is that you don't have to shed your identity to minister to people who may not be of the same denomination. I was up front with everybody right from the beginning that I'm a Lutheran. I'm a conservative Lutheran Christian pastor. And they respected that, and especially, we had every Sunday night a gospel service with...
What does that mean, a gospel
service? An African-American choir that just blew the roof off the tent every Sunday night. And obviously that's out of my comfort zone, because I don't preside over those kinds of services. But we got along great, because they knew where I was coming from. And the common denominator, Chuck, is Jesus. We talk about Jesus. We talk about his death and resurrection. We talk about how when we believe in him, we're going to live forever. And if you're in an African-American gospel choir from a Pentecostal background, or you're coming from a mainline church and are used to drums and guitars in worship, or if you come from a traditional Lutheran church where you have the organ and the hymnal, Jesus is what unites us. Now, having said that, my own denominational peculiarities always were evident, and I let them know. I'm coming at this from a particular theological perspective.
Anybody offended by that?
As long as they knew that this was my theological perspective, they might disagree, and we would talk about it. And those would be awesome discussions.
Isn't that really a wonderful thing?
Yes. We had such excellent discussions because... and one thing you do have to know is when I'm up there preaching to a congregation that is largely from, let's say, a Baptist background, which many of them were, I'm not going to be pounding the pulpit saying, "You're wrong for not baptizing infants, and here's why we should be baptizing infants." We'll get into that when we get into Bible studies and when we talk about, you know, when we're talking one-on-one. But when you're up there preaching, you talk about the love of God and the salvation of Jesus Christ. And if you're Pentecostal, Methodist, Lutheran, that's the message. I was there for 16, 17 Sundays and talked about Jesus on every one of them, approaching it from different angles, his death and resurrection, sin and salvation, and never ran out of things to talk about, and never had to say anything that was going to get me in trouble, because when we talked about the things that we differed about, we did it in a respectful Bible class setting where you could talk openly about it.
I wonder if you could give me the soldier's answer here. Not necessarily Kurt Taylor's answer, but the soldier's answer, the best of your ability. For the person who says, "I love my country too, and I'm willing to die to defend my country." But we're not defending our country. We've invaded Iraq. We've invaded Afghanistan. We're on the offensive here, and this doesn't have anything to do with defending our country. How does the American airman or soldier answer that?
To a person.
Meaning everyone.
Everyone. They believe that what they're doing is noble and right. See, we're not the ones that make the decisions whether we're going to go into this conflict or that. In the military, you are creatures of order. When you are told to do something, you do it. We go over there, we deploy, knowing that our country, our president, and Congress, they've made this decision that this is the right thing for our country to do. And so we do it. And we're glad to do it because then we begin to see that this is something that, this is a role that we play now in this time in our nation's history to make this world and our country better and more free. And so I'd never experienced from anybody second-guessing or downplaying what decisions have been made. We were there to do a job, and we were going to do it.
We have been making our way through the Book of Romans here in our 10 o'clock hour, and we've actually said something that sounds like this. Prior to conversion, human beings are slaves. Slaves to sin. There's nothing that you can do to escape that slavery. You are enslaved by it. But then comes conversion. Then God breaks in, redeems you, and you are no longer a slave to sin. Now, you are a slave to God. We talked about that. What kind of a transition is that? Shouldn't it be from slave to free? But there was a kind of a military context that worked its way into that. I'm thinking maybe military people can understand what it means to be a slave to God from their perspective, because they're doing something that they otherwise might not really want to do, but somehow they are doing it. Then they consider it noble, and they do it willingly.
Yeah.
Can you come at that from a military perspective?
That's well put. That's an excellent perspective, because it's true that, you know, I wouldn't have chosen, and none of these individuals that I worked with would have chosen to get on a 20-hour flight and land in the middle of Kyrgyzstan. But you are a servant of the nation, and when the nation tells you that this is where you need to go serve, you salute and you go do it. And you're right. There is a sense of nobility and pride and honor to be able to serve in this sort of way. And I think that's an excellent comparison when we look at ourselves as being slaves to God. We serve Him, we work for Him, but we're glad to do it. And because of what God has done for us. And I think when people in the military approach the service that we perform for our country, I think that is an attitude that is prevailing. We get to do this.
You're listening to the Bible Study. If you'd like to put a question to Pastor Kurt Taylor, the numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And we'll be right back.
Diane Summers.
And I'm Steve Siegel. On the next afternoon show here on AM 850 KFUO, we'll be talking with Dr. Carl Werner about evolution and creation with his new textbook, Evolution, the Grand Experiment.
Jane Wilkie is our guest to talk about a new Bible study series, a new song from CPH.
And how to culture-proof your kids, building character in your children with Jeannie St. John Taylor.
Join us for the afternoon show 3 to 6 Tuesday on AM 850 KFUO.
The Missouri Botanical Garden has made going green even easier for local gardeners in 2008. The popular plastic pot recycling program has been expanded from 6 weekends to a 6-month collection period. Just drop off plastic garden pots, polystyrene cell packs and trays anytime between 9 in the morning and 4 p.m. now through October 31st. Collection trailers are located at the garden's Monsanto Center parking lot, 4500 Shaw Boulevard at Van Deventer Avenue, and at 7 retail garden centers throughout St. Louis.
A closer and sticky look at the gecko's feet, coming up next on today's Creation Moment. And now, here's our Creation Moments host, Ian Taylor.
Here on Creation Moments, we have often mentioned the gecko's amazing ability to walk up, or even upside down, on surfaces as smooth as glass. We have pointed out that the gecko grips even a glass surface as it walks with microscopic hairs on its feet. These minute hairs actually grip the surface at the molecular level. Noting that geckos never seem to clean their feet, scientists wondered what would happen if the microscopic hairs became fouled with microscopic dust particles. They computed that particles would have to foul between 26 and 59 hairs on each foot to be effective. They then fouled geckos' feet with microspheres and observed them as they walked on a glass surface. To their surprise, with each step, the gecko's grip on the glass surface became stronger. This result suggested that with each step, the gecko's feet were shedding some of the microspheres. To determine if this was what was happening, scientists removed some of the fibers from the gecko's feet and studied their interaction with the microspheres. Their conclusion was that gecko feet are indeed self-cleaning. Not only is the design of the gecko's feet amazing, but God evidently realized that his design would not work unless it was self-cleaning and able to shed dust. This design certainly cannot be attributed to a hit-and-miss process like evolution.
For a free copy of our Creation Resource Catalog, visit our website at creationmoments.com. Or call us toll-free at 1-800-42-BIBLE. And be sure to join us next time for another Creation Moment, proclaiming evidence of God's truth.
AM 850 KFUO salutes our day sponsors on this Memorial Day, Monday, May 26, 2008, Floyd and Laura Bowles. Today's day sponsors have made a contribution to AM 850 KFUO in thanksgiving to God both for keeping their four children safe and for a safe return from several tours in Iraq. Once again, a very special thank you to Floyd and Laura Bowles of Camden, South Carolina, today's AM 850 KFUO day sponsors.
In downtown St. Louis, all points lead to the riverfront. And if you've not done so in a long time, or if you've never been there, now may be the time to look at the Jefferson National Expansion Memorial and view the region from 630 feet up in the air inside the Gateway Arch. It's only closed 3 days a year, and you can take advantage of the extended summer hours between Memorial Day and Labor Day. To learn more online, visit www.gatewayarch.com.
I'm Chuck Rathard. You're listening to an Ask the Pastor Bible Study. Pastor Kurt Taylor is with us here today. Just back this past spring from a tour of duty, I guess that's what you would call it. He is pastor at St. John's Lutheran Church in Waltz, Michigan, and let's take this phone call. Hi, Marilyn, you're on the Bible study.
Good morning, Chuck.
Good morning.
Morning, Pastor. I don't know your rank. Perhaps you told that at the beginning.
What is your rank? Hold on, let me turn on your microphone here.
Yeah, I'm a major. I pinned on major about a year ago. Yeah.
So. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
And my question is, my son, too, is in the military, and he's starting his 21st year, and he is a colonel, this time commander over a bomb holder in Germany.
Wow.
And he has the same feelings that you do, that there's good feelings among the men and women that are serving. But yet, we don't get that kind of message through the media at all.
Right.
Newspaper-wise, radio, television, it's all bad news. It's all these suicides these people are having, et cetera. I'd like you to expand a little bit on that, if you wouldn't mind.
Thank
sure.
you, Marilyn.
And Marilyn, if your son is a colonel and a commander, I hope you are proud of him, because... That is.
Oh, she's proud of him. I know that.
That is a major accomplishment. Marilyn's right, and she reiterates something that we said before. In the military, there is a sense of not only duty but honor to serve our country the way that we are, and so there are always things that get our military people down. It's the big picture that's the important picture. And the big picture is that we get to do something for the sake of freedom. And we try to place ourselves in historical perspective, because all, you know, so many of the generations of Americans throughout history have had to step up at their particular time and do something for the sake of their country, defend it, go overseas, and so on. And I think so many of us in the military see this now as our opportunity, this generation's opportunity, to do something for the sake of freedom and for this country. And when we see that big picture perspective, I think that's where we find your servicemen and women glad to serve, honored to serve. We train to serve, and so that's the other thing. Everything we do back here in the States is designed toward getting us overseas, where we can function in theater. And so when the time finally comes to do that, there is a sense of, well, this is what I've been waiting for. This is what I've been training for. Yeah, it might be dangerous, and it's going to be different, and there's going to be sacrifice, but this is what I do. And you put those two things together, and that's why there is a lot of pride and honor.
A follow-up question on a subject that we were talking about before. Since you're serving in a place where there are Christians of various denominations, various backgrounds, in the Lutheran tradition, it is, I guess I would say, typical to practice communion in what is called a closed communion perspective. Some churches have open communion. You come to church, you're welcome to come communion. Some churches have a perspective that, well, you know, let's talk about, you know, what you believe and what your faith is and whether or not that's consistent with the rest of the saints here at this particular congregation. How does that all play out in a military situation, the one that you were in?
I was the only Protestant chaplain on our base, and it was expected of me to offer communion, expected by the commander, expected by my boss in what they call the Central Air Force.
What do you mean your boss?
The
your
chaplain.
Commander your boss?
Well, the base commander is my boss, and then the chaplain that oversees the chaplains in theater is also my boss. It was expected that as the only Protestant chaplain on that base, I would provide communion for the Protestants. But we practice close communion at my church in Michigan. I am a firm believer in close communion. And it was going to be a difficult thing, and I knew this going in, because I knew that I would be expected to offer communion, how to handle this, because I would not just stand up there with some bread and wine and say, y'all come. So I took some advice from a synod president. I don't remember which one it was. But there was a military chaplain overseas that was asking this very question, how he was expected to offer communion, but there were people of differing faiths, Christian faiths and backgrounds. And that synod president's advice to him was, make them Lutheran. So, what that meant was, when it came to communion, I would not offer it at all of the services. I would name which service we were going to have it at, and it would be the same one. We did it three times while I was there. I told them, here is how communion is going to be delivered here. I believe it's the true body and blood of Jesus, given to us for the forgiveness of our sins and the strengthening of our faith. I believe that the Lord's Supper is a gift from God, whereby God actually works through it, and that we approach it in faith, that we need communion because we are sinful. And right there, that eliminated a number of people who would have come to communion, people that don't believe it's the body and blood of Christ, and so on. And so they, I think respectfully, I respected them for this, they chose not to come. Then what we did is during the service it would be about what this gift of the Lord's Supper is. And I taught it from our Lutheran perspective, so that once we got done with the sermon, which would be treating the Lord's Supper the way that we understand it, talking about doctrine the way that we understand it, I then would say, if you believe this, and if you are in agreement with the things that, I've said and the doctrine that I've taught you, then you come to communion. And with that, we had a number of individuals who, again, did not come because they could not agree with it. And but that's how we handled it. Now, I think there are a couple of things that need to be said, because I'm one of those pastors in this country that feels strongly about close communion. And I'm one of those pastors that when I see congregations in our own church body that say, y'all come, no matter who you are or what you believe, I'm one of those pastors that thinks that's not the right way of approaching the Lord's Supper. It's close communion. But even in our own theology, in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, we understand that there are sometimes extraordinary circumstances where strict close communion can't be practiced. And you'll find this in the very language of our church body giving direction to its pastors. Extraordinary circumstances. If a woman who is ELCA is on her deathbed and desires the body and blood of the Lord once more before she dies, are we going to say no to her? That's the kind of extraordinary circumstance that Lutheran pastors have some latitude to make pastoral decisions and to administer communion in a pastoral way. I would argue that a war zone is an extraordinary circumstance. You have individuals who tomorrow may be sent off and die. You have individuals who this may be, you know, their only chance at receiving the body and blood of the Lord before they go into a war zone and are getting shot at for the next number of days or whatever. And so I also look at this as an extraordinary circumstance where an LCMS pastor has some latitude as to how he can administer the Lord's Supper. There are going to be some, Chuck, that completely disagree with how I approached that, that would probably label me as a liberal. There are probably others out there who would say, you know, you shouldn't have made it so difficult. But to try and balance what we believe as Lutheran Christian pastors about communion and close communion with what my duty was in the war zone was a very difficult thing and a prayerful thing. And I don't know if I did it right or not, but it was something where I felt that was the only way I could do it.
Well, I think that most folks would just appreciate your willingness to think it through and to make Jesus the center of the question. And then, to the best of your human ability, whether you're in a war zone around the world or whether you're dealing with a question right here in your own home with your own family, we're left to sort it out.
Right.
And you go at that with good motivation, a good heart, and then you're done.
Yeah.
And you move on to the next question.
That's right. That's right.
You get YouTube. You got the internet over there. You get YouTube.
Where I live or over in...
Washington?
No, there are certain things that we couldn't get over there. We could we could get you know, Fox News and things like that, and but no, not YouTube. Not
well, here's something I saw on Fox News just this week. It was videotape, kind of scattered videotape, of an encounter between a husband and a wife who, for some reason, had decided to demonstrate publicly in favor of the military. And they were met by some young people, very young people, who didn't hold that view. And pretty soon there was a scuffle and there were arrests. These young people in the video that I saw, which was not a complete record of the event, so I'm not trying to come down here on one side or the other, but if soldiers or airmen see that, does that have an impact on them?
If they see enough of it, it can. But we also know, because we're able to communicate well with people back home, we also know the support that we have. One of the things, the TV stations that we get over there are called the American Forces Network. And one of the things that they try hard to do, while they don't sanitize the news, people figure that we get everything censored, you know, and that it's all just rah-rah pro-America. They don't censor the news, but what they do is make sure that we understand that people back here support us when we're overseas. And when we hear about the protests and the demonstrations and the people that don't like what's going on, we know that they're protesting political decisions and not us. And they have the right to do that. And when they do that, we talk to each other over there saying, you know what, it's a good thing we're here because we're giving them the right to do that.
I saw a YouTube video of an old veteran, a man who looked to be in his late 40s, maybe 50s, living in the American Southwest, who did this deliberately, and we know that because he was videotaped. There was a restaurant, and the restaurant had a flagpole in front of the building, and on the flagpole they had first at the top of the flagpole the Mexican flag, and then just beneath that the American flag. And the video was the veteran walking up to this flagpole, a number of people standing around the restaurant observing this, lowering the lanyard, cutting the Mexican flag out of the lanyard, dropping it to the ground, taking the American flag. And then he looks at the camera and he says, I'm an American veteran. I know people who died for this flag.
I saw that clip.
Did you?
I saw that.
And what did you think?
There was, you hang around veterans and you know how much pride they have in this country and in our flag, and I admire that pride. I don't think I would have done what he did, and tear down the Mexican flag, but I understand why he did it. Whenever something like the flag is treated less than with the utmost honor, that is seen as an affront to our nation, by many who have served, because the flag was that which represented home, what we were fighting for. The flag is what we stood up at attention to every day, and it represents America, so that when the flag is somehow treated unfavorably, people get upset about it. And so I can understand that kind of fervor. I think it's good. I don't know if that's how you... I don't think that's how I would have played out that fervor, but it's good.
You wrote a piece which was published, I guess this up in your district, is that right?
That's right.
There are a couple of things here that I want to ask you about here before we run out of time. You write, an important ministry done by the chapel is the administration of the Manas, is that the way you pronounce it?
Yeah, Manas. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Air Base Outreach Society. This organization supports a number of orphanages and children's hospitals in our host nation. Many airmen from our base spend their day off visiting the children of Kyrgyzstan in these places. They bring them gifts, repair their rundown buildings, or just play with them. Tens of thousands of dollars have been given from the pockets of your airmen for the betterment of these children. Can you talk about that?
The Manas Air Base Outreach Society, or MABOS for short, was established shortly after our base was established. Our base in Kyrgyzstan was established right after September 11th. This was one of the first things that America did, September 11th, 2001. One of the first things that America did as it was preparing to respond to the terrorist threats. It's the only base, the only American base in a former Soviet state. But when the Americans arrived there, one of the first things that Americans decided to do was help the people who were in that country, because it's a very poor country. There are people that the amount of money they make every year, the way that many of these people live, the way that children live, it's unacceptable to American sensibilities. And so one of the first things that we did once we arrived there was start helping the children. It started out with helping with heart surgeries, because children that were born with minor heart problems, who in this country would have a relatively minor operation and be fine, in Kyrgyzstan they die because the families can't afford to pay for a heart operation. $560 is how much it cost. And so we started years ago collecting money from our airmen to go for these heart operations so that these kids could live. And it kind of expanded. So that now this Mabos serves five orphanages and Children's Cancer Center, the Children's Heart Center. And that's what our airmen do when we have the opportunity to get off base. We go and help these kids. One place, one of the orphanages that we support was in a town called Takmak, which was an hour and a half drive from our base. And once in a while we were allowed to go there. And we got there and found out that these kids would get a shower at this orphanage. They get a shower once every 15 days. And in order to get that shower, they had to walk across town, across dirt roads, to go take that shower. Any mom would tell you, well, you take your shower and then you walk home on a dirt road. As soon as you get home, you're going to need a shower. So what our servicemen and women did was took some of their days off and went to that orphanage and built five showers in that place for those kids. That's the kind of thing that your soldiers and sailors and airmen and Marines do, even when they're over in the war zone. I talked to so many people who were coming up from downrange, and they knew about what we were doing in Kyrgyzstan, and they said, too, yeah, they would adopt a particular village, and servicemen would go and try and help the orphans whenever they could, take them something to eat, play with them. That's the kind of thing that we do. That's the kind of people that are serving in the military of this country. And it was a very successful, continues to be a successful program, and we get donations from back here and are able to do a lot, because a little bit can go an awful long way in a country like Kyrgyzstan.
Let's take a call here before we run out of time. Linda, you're on the Bible study. Good morning.
Hi, Brother Radford.
Good morning.
Pastor, thank you.
Hi, Linda.
Hi. Thank you for all you do.
Thank you.
For our servicemen and for their families, that they know you're there.
It's our pleasure to do that. It's an honor to do that. And thank you for saying that, because when we're over there, it's because of people like you back here that we're able to serve with pride.
God bless you.
Thanks, you too.
Pastor Taylor, there is another section to the article that you wrote up in your district in Michigan. You talk about just playing with children, one child that you were just kind of playing catch with. And you say that he couldn't speak English, nor I Russian, but I knew what he meant. He wanted to keep playing catch, and so you said, so we kept on playing. Just to give you an idea of the impact your airmen have on the children of Kyrgyzstan, one of the orphans was asked through an interpreter what he wanted to be when he grew up. His answer, an American soldier.
Mm-hmm. This is what people don't see. This is the part of military service and being in the war zone that I don't think people are aware of. Our servicemen, when we're over there, this is just the kind of thing that we do. We help as much as we can. Now, obviously, we're over there to prosecute a war, but we also see that we have opportunity to make a difference in the lives of these people, and they're eager to do it. Young Chuck, these are our youngest airmen who could be playing pool on their day off. We had a pool table or watching the big screen television. They didn't do that. They scheduled their days off to get into these trips where we'd go into town and help these kids. These kids see us, and they don't see us, I don't think, as aggressors or mean and rough, because when we come bearing candy and clothes and teddy bears and hammers that we're going to use to build a new bunk or repair the medical room in the orphanage, so that their exposure to America is through these airmen who go and make their lives better. Now, I think that's an excellent thing for our country, that people in situations like that and in countries like that, that their exposure to our citizens are, yes, soldiers and airmen who are there to prosecute a war, but who are also, as long as they're there, going to do their best to make lives better for people.
We have just about 2 minutes left here. You know, there's a place somewhere in the Gospels where, I think it was some Greeks, I don't know, I could be wrong on this, approached Jesus' disciples, and they said, we would see Jesus. And that has been a kind of a contextual call to pastors down through the ages, that the people who come to worship or the people who come to Bible study are really saying, we would see Jesus. In your experience as a chaplain, have you seen Jesus? Can you see Jesus better in that setting than the rest of us who are so busy with all the affairs of American life?
When we got there and saw the circumstances we were in and how we would be living for the next 4 months, which wasn't bad, lived in a dorm. But then when I saw what my responsibilities were going to be, which were much greater than I thought they were going to be when I left, it was funny. I said to God out loud, God, if this is going to work, you're going to have to be the one to do it. And for the next 4 months, he proceeded to demonstrate to me how well he can do things. We had a service on Christmas Eve where, and I mentioned this in the article, where all of us were so far away from home, but we were together on Christmas Eve talking about, rejoicing about the birth of Jesus, our Savior. And when that service was done, nobody left the chapel that night. They stayed around. Odd to me. I mean, that's the first thing you want to do when church is done, is get out of church, right? They didn't. They stayed there. The service was done, but our airmen stayed there, many in tears, many embracing each other. We had no family there. We had no longtime friends. The people that we were with were people that we had just met a few months before. But that night, we were all we had, and what brought us together was the birth of a Savior named Jesus Christ. And that was me seeing Jesus there in this tent in the middle of a place that I had never heard of and had never been before, to see the love between these people because of Christ and to hear again of Christ's love for us. That's where Jesus was.
I have long looked forward to this conversation, and I'm so grateful that we were able to have it face-to-face.
Me too, Chuck.
I know you got a plane to catch. God's blessings as you return to what is a normal American life, and we look forward to our next chat. It'll probably be on a Bible text.
You bet.
Thank you, Pastor Kurt Taylor, here on our Ask the Pastor program. Thanks for listening.
Listen to Chuck Ratherton guests Monday through Friday at the same time on The Bible Study. The Bible Study is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for The Bible Study to continue. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the Internet at kfuo.org. For a free copy of The Bible Study, please visit the audio archive section of our homepage. That's kfuo.org. The Bible Study is a broadcast service of Worldwide KFUO.